I'm gonna go. Okay, so today I'm going to talk about a really terrible person. He's honestly horrific. His name is Dean Corll. I think people might have heard about him. He's like a really prolific serial killer, but he wasn't in the media as much. Like, he predates Ted Bundy, predates the Green River Killer. Like, he's pretty early. And at the time that he was found out, I'll say, he actually had the most bodies out of any serial killer in the U.S.
Oh, wow. Out of everyone altogether.
Yeah, but he predated Ted Bundy, predated right. all the big guys, and actually a lot of other serial killers copied him, interesting enough. But
very interesting.
Also, I don't want to ruin the ending, but he doesn't get arrested, but he okay. dies. So that's why he wasn't very popular, because he never got interviewed like Bundy. Like, people didn't really get into his mind or understand why. So all this information is coming from two other people.
What dates are we talking about?
Like, so what? He was born in 1939, okay. and he was active from what we know from 1970 to 1973.
Okay. That's before Bundy?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's before the word serial killer was even coined.
Right.
And it's before Bundy.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure. Let me just look it up.
The term serial killer, wasn't that for Ed Kemper? Or who was it coined for?
It was coined by the Mindhunter guy.
Right.
When did he start? Ted Bundy started killing women and girls in the 1970s, but I think so.
It was the later 70s.
It was the later half, and Dean Corll was found out in 73.
Oh,
so
okay,
I think the serial killers were active that we know, but they weren't caught yet, and they weren't sensationalized yet because they didn't know who they were.
Okay.
So I do want to give a trigger warning that he sexually assaults and murders a lot of children.
Okay.
Teenage boys in particular. So he has a few monikers, if you're not familiar with the name Dean Corll: the Candyman, the Candyman Killer, and the Pied Piper. The murders are also known as the Houston Mass Murders, because at that time it was he had the most bodies out of any serial killer in the country, and it was such a big phenomenon that it was known as the Houston Mass Murders in the country, and the victims are often referred to as the Lost Boys. Okay, I'm going to start about his life. So Dean Corll was unfortunately born on Christmas Eve, 1939. It's very unfortunate he was born. He's the worst. So he was the first child to marry an Arnold Corll, and by all accounts, his dad didn't really like children. He didn't like having them around.
So typical.
Yeah, but why have kids then if you don't like them? But I digress.
Be like every other dad and just leave or something.
Yeah, no, but he didn't leave. He stuck around, but he just didn't like him. And everything I read kind of pointed to that. It wasn't like he was abusive or blah, 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 but he just didn't like having kids around, and he was really, really strict. So he didn't really show Dean or his younger brother, Stanley, any affection. But on the other hand, the boy's mother, Mary, was literally obsessed with the two boys. And she was really protective of them. And she especially adored Dean.
Wow.
So on one hand, he had kind of like an absent father who worked a lot, who was really strict. But his mom was like, you can do no wrong. You are my angel. Like,
getting mixed messages from them.
Yeah, for sure. So Mary and Arnold, the parents, they fought a lot. So in 1946, when Dean Corll was 6 years old, the couple divorced. I didn't see anywhere that this was ever violent or like physically abusive. I just want to point that out. So it seemed like it was pretty amicable. They just bickered and argued verbally a lot. So they decided to call it quits. But after the divorce, the boys live with their mother, and their father was drafted into the Air Force. So their father moved to Memphis, Tennessee, where he was put at a base there. Mm-hmm. Mary found it to be really lonely in Illinois without her ex-husband, which I thought was kind of weird. You guys did get divorced, but whatever. So
she, find someone new.
Yeah, right. So, oh, don't worry. She does find a few. Oh,
okay.
She is interesting, but so she thought the boys should also have a relationship with their father. So she and the boys moved to Memphis and they moved into a trailer park there. And now that, so Mary and Arnold were still divorced at this time and Arnold was working in the Air Force. So Mary had to work to support her family. So Dane and his brother were often left with their elderly neighbors or any random babysitter. And this forced Dean to be very independent from a young age, but it also made him like yearn for his mother's affection and approval and time because he didn't get that. During this time, he even had undiagnosed rheumatic fever and they didn't find out. Yeah, right. And like he was that sick and no one knew.
Wow.
That's pretty bad. I mean, it is neglectful.
Right.
And they didn't find out until high school during a physical because he had a heart murmur.
Wait, so rheumatic fever, like, how would you not be able to tell that that was going on?
I guess, like, I guess his mom probably just thought he was, like, a little bit sick.
Okay.
You know? And not, like...
Like, he'll eventually get over this.
Yeah. And it gave him a heart murmur, so... Wow. And they didn't find out till he was in high school, and they think he got the fever around when he was, like, 6 or 7 years old when they first moved to Memphis.
Oh, my God.
It's really sad. So... also during this time, Dean was described as like a shy, serious child who didn't socialize much, but his brother Stanley, who was younger, was super outgoing, made a lot of friends. But Dean really just stuck more to his family. Like he was close with his brother and close with his mom, but not super sociable. So in 1950, Mary and Arnold Kaur got remarried.
No.
Yeah.
That's never a good idea.
I know. It's awful. They were divorced for 4 years and then decided, hey, you know.
There's a reason why you separated in the first place.
I know. I think this kind of like fucks him up a little bit. But
I'm sure.
So this is when the family relocates to Texas where all of the murders happened. So they moved to Pasadena, Texas, where Mary and Arnold were happily married for 3 years and then divorced again in 1953.
I don't think they even made it three years.
I doubt it was happy, but yeah. So Dean Coral was 14 at this point when his parents had gotten the second divorce. So by all accounts, the divorce was amicable. And once again, Mary was granted full custody. And the boys did remain in contact with their father. It's not clear how often they saw him, but Arnold, the father, does circle back later in the story. So Dean definitely had a relationship with him throughout the rest of his life. So guess what? Pretty soon after the divorce, Mary got remarried.
But
not to Arnold. To a traveling clock salesman named Jake West.
Okay.
Yeah. So the family moved to the small town of Vidor, Texas. Vidor. I should know that because I am literally from Texas and I have driven through this town. Vidor? It's probably Vidor or something.
Vidor,
Texas.
I like that.
I can have the accent because I'm from there. I'm not making fun of it.
Of course.
Okay. This is a little town outside of Beaumont on the Texas-Louisiana border. It's about an hour and a half from Houston. So it's really, in Texas terms, that's close to a city. Like, that's pretty close to Houston. It's... And Beaumont, I mean, at this time, I don't think it was huge, but Beaumont isn't like, I mean, Beaumont's a small city, but it still has like some businesses. Like there's,
I mean, I've definitely heard of Beaumont, Texas for sure.
Yeah. So
like it rings a bell. I think
exactly. So, in 1955, Mary and Jake West had a little girl named Joyce West. Dean was 16 at this time. So his actual parents, Mary and Arnold, got divorced when Dean was 14. By the time Dean was 16, his mother remarried Jake West and had another baby.
Okay, wow. Very fast.
Yeah. So apparently he was extremely protective of Joyce and his brother Stanley. Like extremely protective of his little siblings and helped raise them. And his mother just absolutely adored him. And I mean, besides all the divorces and remarriages, it seems like his family life was pretty uneventful. Like... He was left at home, but it seems like at this point, once they got remarried, his family life was more normal. Mm-hmm. And I really do think, like, if this was a nature versus nurture argument, I have to lean on the side of nature.
Right.
I just don't, I think a lot of people come from, like, quote unquote broken home, or like people getting remarried, and it just doesn't really have, you know, I really think he was born.
It's not the typical, like, traumatic head injury, abusive household type of story.
Exactly. Exactly. So Mary and Jake, his mom and stepfather, started a candy business in their garage in Vidor, Texas. And what do you know? They have two great workers that they don't have to pay.
We their love sons, child labor. Dean and
Stanley.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. So from the early days, Dean and Stanley would work night and day between school and the candy business.
Poor kids.
The boys, I know. The boys were responsible for running the candy making machines and packaging up all the product.
Oh my gosh. Their I hope they were getting something out of it. Like,
yeah, I mean,
free candy. I guess
in the 70s, maybe it's like more normal to help your family. I guess it's like normal still to help your family, but.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, it seems like they did a lot of work.
Right. Also, they should have some type of choice in it.
Right. So there's. They made the candy, whatever. Their stepfather, Jake, would sell all the candy on a sales route. Because remember, he used to be a traveling clock salesman.
Ah, but now
he switched to candy on his sales route. So, and the closest big city was Houston. So Jake would drive to Houston, stop, make a few stops on the way, but basically sell all of the candy in Houston. At this time, Dean was in high school. He attended Vidor High School. And he was just completely average, normal kid. He wasn't a star student or athlete, but he wasn't a troublemaker, like super into partying. He got average grades and was just an average kid, like literally nothing crazy. I did find stuff that said he was described as a loner, but he had a few girlfriends at the time and a few friends. So I don't know if the loner thing is just like hindsight after his crimes, like people writing about it that way to make him seem like, oh, we should have known this was coming.
It definitely seems like if he had a girlfriend, I mean, unless he was from like the alt group.
You know. No, he wasn't. He wasn't alt. He was just like completely run-of-the-mill normal. Like he wasn't, you know, so I really don't think he was that much of a loner.
Yeah.
Like, but he graduated high school in 19, oh, but he also couldn't play sports because of the heart murmur.
Oh,
so
sure.
I think, so he wasn't popular in that way. Like,
okay.
He didn't play sports at all. He couldn't even do PE.
Right.
He was in the band, but I don't think he was. Maybe people called him a loner that were, like, super athletic and cool because they didn't see that he had other friends. But he had a few girlfriends. Like,
so you typical. Know what
I
mean?
I don't think it was, like, yeah, exactly. I don't think it was, like, he was killing people's cats and dogs and didn't speak to anyone kind of
right.
thing, you know?
It's definitely painting him after the fact.
Yeah, so he graduated high school in 1958, and right after his graduation, the family moved to Houston so they could run the candy business there because they sold all the candy there. It was just easier. Mm-hmm. And they opened up a shop called the Pecan Prince.
Ooh. And,
yeah, Pecan Prince. And Coral started working there full time. So going into his early adulthood, 2 years after the move to Houston in 1960, Dean Coral moved back to Indiana to live with his widowed grandmother. His mother had asked him to do this, and he didn't mind, so he created a little life there. I mean, this is so nice.
Oh my gosh, like, what a nice kid.
You would think I have the sweetest son. Like, he's going to go take care of his widowed grandmother.
If anyone asked me to do that, I'm sorry, but at that age, it would be a flat no.
Yeah, exactly. He's 20 years old, like 19.
Right. I want to hang out with my friends.
Yeah, he's 21. I just did the math in my head, but there's no way you could fucking pay me to do that.
No.
Now at 24, yes, yeah, I'll go live with my
exactly.
grandma. But at 21, absolutely
no way.
Not.
Also, moving all the way to Indiana too.
Yeah,
it's
where
a big
he
ask.
Went to high school in Texas. Exactly. So, yeah. He created like a life there. He even had a girlfriend that proposed to him.
What?
Like, she was so in love with him, she proposed to him, and he rejected it.
I need to see a picture of him.
So he rejected this girl's proposal. But other than that, he was just living a completely normal life, looking after his grandmother, meeting girls,
wow.
apparently falling in love with a woman. And he lived there for 2 years.
Wow.
And just like normal. And then in 1962, 2 years
I have a
later,
feeling that's going to change.
Yeah, I mean, just wait. It kind of seems like it's like a flip of a switch in a way. But in 1962, Coral was 23. He moved back to Houston to help run the family candy business, which had relocated to the Houston Heights neighborhood. And this neighborhood, the Houston Heights, became Coral's hunting ground. And 47 plus boys would go missing in the years that Coral lived
47?
Here. Not all of them are linked to him, but they believe that there are more bodies. I'll get into that in part
47.
47 boys went missing while Coral. And they actually think more boys. They have no idea how many boys this man killed.
Oh my God. Okay. I'm going to need to know the details.
Yeah. So this is definitely going to be a two-parter. There's just too many victims. Yeah. I want to make sure I treat them with much grace and I give information on them. And it's been so hard. I mean, these boys disappeared in the 70s. So it's, the internet wasn't as, you know, like, I mean, you just couldn't put a blog up about someone that had passed away and find out all this information. So right. I'm trying to find out more information about each of these boys as I speak about them. And so I need to do a part two.
Definitely.
Anyways, fun fact is that my sister lives in this neighborhood now with her family. Oh, wow. And I spent a lot of time in this neighborhood over quarantine. I lived there for 6 weeks. So my interest has definitely peaked. Like, I walked up and down this neighborhood, especially because I lived there during peak COVID when all you could do was walk. And she had a toddler that loved to go on walks. So we would walk up and down the neighborhood. I would run that neighborhood all the time with a baby in the stroller. Like, it really piqued my interest because this neighborhood, it's getting extremely gentrified and a lot of young families live there now. But at the time, this was a lower middle class neighborhood, I would definitely say lower, and all the parents worked, the mom worked, the father worked in these neighborhoods. The kids were latchkey kids, and they didn't have a lot of mentors or people showing them things, and that's what Dean Coral preyed on. So
definitely.
It's just really it's interesting. I mean, it's fucked up, but it's definitely interesting. So when Dean moved back to Houston in 1962, guess what? Mary did a year later.
She divorced her husband.
Yes, she divorced Jake West.
Wow, she's getting predictable.
What a surprise. So that's divorce number three.
Does she get remarried?
Girl boss.
Wow.
So she is a girl boss, though, because girl boss, I think when I say girl boss, it's kind of a joke.
Like in a bad way, like an Elizabeth Holmes way.
Yeah. But she opens her own candy business because Jake West takes the candy business in the divorce when it was her fucking girl kids boss. And Mary running it. But she's like, you know what? I'm going to open my own candy business, which is girl boss. And she named it the Coral Candy Company. So she was like, fuck you and your last name, Jake West.
I'm going to use my first husband's
last name and do Coral Candy Company and make my own. So good
alliteration
for her.
Queen.
Right? Female entrepreneur, leaving that husband she didn't like no more. But
females in STEM.
Yeah, exactly.
Except it's entrepreneurship and not engineering.
But it is kind of science because you're cooking, right?
True. Females in STEM.
Yeah. So she appointed her two sons to run the business, and Dean was named vice president of the Coral Candy Company.
Ogre. Guy boss.
Guy boss. So this is when his creepy behavior towards teenage boys begins, by all accounts. I didn't find anything earlier, but maybe because he was a teenager before this, so it didn't seem creepy. But
right
in that same year that Coral Candy Company was opened and Dean was appointed vice president, one of the teenage boy employees made a complaint to Mary that Dean made sexual advances towards him.
Okay.
So Mary did what any good mother would do, and she fired the teenage boy and stuff.
Of course. Can we talk about how brave that boy was, though? Because in this day and age, to say something, especially with like a man.
This was 1963.
Wow. Props to this boy.
And of course, Mary thinks that her son is like end all be all best person in the world. My son would never do that. Yeah. So she just didn't believe him, swept it all under the rug. And she just didn't think Dean could do anything wrong.
Right.
Another surprise move from Mary here. She got remarried.
Okay.
like very quickly. And this time she met her husband on one of the OG online dating services. Like,
wait, there is no internet at this time.
No, there is. They say they
what? Internet? Wasn't the internet invented in like the 90s?
The 1983. I don't think it was like, but I think it was like, it wasn't technically on, like, it wasn't like a phone service,
maybe.
But it was like a phone service. It was like they used an algorithm to match you up, but you submitted your shit.
And then they used with like paper?
Yeah.
Okay.
But so, like, but I think they had computers, though.
They did have computers. So I think they could do an algorithm.
I think it was like an algorithm.
Okay.
But it was like one of the first like algorithm online dating services.
So not only is she a girl boss, but she's also breaking the mold, trying new stuff.
Wow. Oh yeah. So I could not find this man's name literally anywhere.
He wasn't important anymore.
No, but if I find it anywhere, I'll let you guys know in the next episode. But I'm going to refer to him as the Merchant Seaman because that was his job.
Okay.
And that's what every other place referred to him as, the Merchant Seaman. I was like, okay, dope. So the Merchant Seaman. So right after.
That could Mary be a band Mary, name or something.
Yeah, right? It's good. So right after Mary married the Merchant Seaman, Dean was drafted into the army.
Oh, for Vietnam?
Yeah, I guess.
63?
No. It's 60, he got drafted in 64.
64? This is right after JFK's assassination. So we have Johnson, which Vietnam is starting. Yeah. Probably Vietnam, but not into the thick of it yet.
Okay, yeah. But so he got drafted. And I think it was just kind of normal to get drafted at this time, even if there wasn't, like, huge fighting going on, especially, like...
Right.
He didn't see any combat. Because his dad got drafted, too, and his dad got drafted after... I was looking that up because everywhere it said drafted, and I was like, but he got drafted after World War II. Like, I didn't realize there was still a draft going on, but I think that they still drafted people, even... like not during wartime. Like I think it was way more common than we realized.
Also, if you didn't see combat, it's possible that it was like some sort of reserve situation or like a technical job or something.
Yeah. So he was drafted and he was 25. He was a radio repairman in the army.
Okay.
And he fucking hated it. Like he did not want to be there at all. And he never got in trouble or anything. Like,
was he living on base or did he have to move?
Yeah, he was living on base. He had to move.
Okay.
And he never got in trouble or anything, but he applied for a hardship discharge saying his mommy needed him back at home to run the family business. My mommy needs me.
Sucky now.
So by all accounts, this is where Dean Coral realized that he might be gay. Like when he joined the army.
That's super common, actually.
Yeah, I guess being in the army gave him a lot of new experiences, but it also included his first sexual encounters with men.
That's actually how the gay community in San Diego started, because San Diego is such a military city, and it became a gay capital because all these, like, Navy seamen were coming out. Isn't that amazing?
Wait, yeah. That's really cool.
Yes, I love that.
That is really cool. Yeah, so apparently that is... he kind of realized in the army. I mean, I don't know why he hated it then, if he was like kind of in, maybe it was like hard for him to
admit it to himself,
the sexuality stuff. So maybe that's another reason he hated the army, because it was kind of like he was learning things about himself. But once he was discharged, apparently people around him started noticing his behavior change, and people were kind of catching on that maybe he was attracted to men. And this was in the 1960s. It's not like gay rights were widespread at all. So no. I'm sure he tried to keep this to himself and he struggled with it. However, people did notice that his behavior was getting extremely questionable around teenage boys.
Like he was more brazen with it, like not trying to hide it, or
like,
what?
I'll explain.
Okay.
So he jumped after he got discharged to help his mommy. Aww. He jumped right back in at the Coral Candy Company as the vice president, and their biggest competitor was actually Pecan Prince. Their ex stepfather,
no.
The
one their ex,
yeah. So the competition
this is like
was
secession,
right? But the competition was so fierce. So Dan just like threw himself into the business and had to work constantly. And in 1965, the company relocated directly across from Helms Elementary School, which was an elementary school in the same Houston Heights neighborhood.
Doesn't sound and, good.
No, this is where he met a lot of his victims.
No.
He was known as the nice, pleasant, smiling candy man of the Heights because he would pass out free candy to the local children at the elementary school, showing particular interest in boys.
So this is definitely where the stereotype comes from, no? From him.
Yeah, so this is where he gets his moniker.
Candy from strangers and
but he wasn't a stranger. He was like a pinnacle in the community because everyone knew him. And this community was lower... It was so, in the community was lower class. So to have like a business in the community and be passing out free candy, he was like a staple of the community. And like, yes, exactly. Like people called him the nice, pleasant, smiling candy man of the Heights. So not only was he gaining the community's trust and his boys' trust by being this nice guy passing out candy, the Coral Candy Company also employed all the local teenage boys.
What a classic Willy Wonka.
He was literally Willy Wonka. So he installed a pool table in the back of the candy factory where the young employees and the local youths would hang out.
Of course, and be drawn
and
there.
Dean would hang out with them all the time. And so he created this space where all the kids could hang out. They could start trusting him. They would think he's so cool because he's this older guy. You know, it's just like, and they thought they could trust him. So,
of course.
However, Mary's third husband, the merchant seaman, started to see right through this whole facade. He confronted Mary about Dean having sexual relations with the boys he brought around the candy factory. But Mary refused to believe it. And she even told the Houston Post that her son was loyal, obedient, helpful, loving, and a good, normal boy.
Yeah, maybe to you, Mary.
Yeah, because you're not a fucking teenage boy that he can molest.
Exactly. Obviously, wants to be close with his mommy.
Yeah, and guess what happens next? Mary divorces the merchant seaman in 1968.
No.
You want to know why she divorced him?
Because of what he said?
I think that was a big part of it, but another big part was that a Houston sidekick told Mary she needed to leave the seaman and get as far away from him as possible.
What?
Yeah, that's all. I couldn't find if he was abusive or what, but that's what the sidekick told her, and she just fucking ran with it. So
nice.
In 1968, she sent the seaman to the curb, closed the Coral Candy Company, and moved to Colorado with her daughter, Joyce.
And Dean is where?
Dean has stayed in Houston, but so Dean is 29 at this time.
Okay.
And this would be the last time Mary ever saw Dean. They would often talk on the phone, but they never saw each other again after she
moved away. But if she loves him so much, wouldn't you think she would be in contact with him more?
They talked on the phone all the time, but they never saw each other again. He wasn't alive for much long after this.
She didn't want to like bring him to Colorado or?
No, he wanted to stay in Houston because he got all the – he was like – the second his mom left was when he started his spree.
Oh, okay.
So and he finally got the green pass
or something.
He had been like compressing all of this, like these feelings really. And then with his mom leaving, he knew that he would have like an opening. So, after the candy company closed, Dean Coral began working as an electrician for the Houston Lighting and Power Company. He kind of had been working as an electrician on and off like in his 20s too. So, makes sense. So now I'm going to kind of jump back a little bit to David Brooks. David Brooks becomes an accomplice of Coral, but he was groomed since he was in sixth grade. So jumping back a little bit here, in 1967, Coral befriended David Brooks. At the time, Brooks was a nerdy little sixth grader with big glasses. He was often described as sickly. He was just skinny and smaller than the other kids. And it definitely was like a big insecurity for him. And he had really big dorky glasses. And a lot of older men would make fun of him. Like the first thing they said to him, they would make fun of him. His dad would call him a sissy all the time. He just didn't have a great family life. So when Coral befriended him, Brooks really was like, wow, this started to see him as a father figure. Coral never made fun of him for his looks. Wow. He was always kind to him. So he played on him.
Remember, right, exactly.
Like, and remember, really, Coral's 28 years old and this kid's in sixth grade.
Of course. He saw the opportunity and took advantage of it. And it's just so sad because this little kid has never known.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably a good relationship with a fellow boy. With what I mean?
With like another adult man.
Right.
He's never. I'll get into that now. Okay. But he never had another positive relationship with another adult male. So.
Right.
And I do want to make, okay, so he became one of, like, the many young boys that spent a lot of time with Coral and hung out at the Candy Factory. So this was, he was befriended before the Candy Factory closed. I just wanted to get all of that backstory before I started talking about David Brooks. So
he's, like, one of the kids that's doing pool, playing pool.
Yeah, and he's, like, always there. And Coral would, like, if Brooks needed any money, Coral would give it to him. He would take him on business trips. He took to South Texas where there's like beaches and stuff. And he wasn't the only boy that Coral would take on these trips, but Brooks soon became his favorite. And like Brooks really began to see Coral as a father figure, but he was being groomed. Like along with many other young boys and teenagers in this situation, like Brooks was being groomed.
Right.
He lived with his father who, like I said, was super tough on him and he worked constantly. Like his mother lived in a different city. So he was just with his dad that was super mean to him. So, and his former attorney actually spoke out and said Brooks idolized Coral. He said that Dean was the first adult male who didn't make fun of him. Just 2 years after befriending Brooks, Coral started sexually assaulting him. Brooks has said that the abuse began in 1969, so Brooks was in eighth grade. Coral had paid Brooks in cash or with gifts to allow Coral to perform oral sex on him. In 1970, Brooks dropped out of high school, and he moved to Beaumont with his mother. So he got out of the situation. He left Coral behind, and so this was only 3 years after he met Coral. He was like a freshman in high school and he dropped out of high school.
Poor thing.
And he went to, and he went to live with his mom. And the abuse had started at this point. But Beaumont and Houston are only an hour and a half away from each other. So whenever Brooks came back to visit his father, he always went to go see Dean Coral.
Like even by his choice?
Yeah, by his choice. And he started to stay at Dean Coral's apartment all the time in Houston. And he, like, started to see it as his second home. So his mother left in 1968. And that is when Coral started embracing, like, his grossest, darkest compulsions. And this is when all the abuse started, including to David Brooks. So, like I said earlier, a lot of this information and timeline comes from David Brooks because Dean was never interviewed or investigated by police. So, sorry, I just need to, okay. He's so gross. So, shortly after Coral started molesting Brooks, Brooks realized that he was not the only boy that this was being done to. In December 1970, this was after Brooks had moved to Beaumont, but he actually, I don't know. Okay, so in December 1970, Brooks walked, but he was visiting Houston, and he saw Coral's apartment as a second home, so he was going there, and Brooks walked unannounced into Coral's apartment, and he saw two naked boys tied to Coral's this wooden board, and it was Dean Coral's torture board.
Oh, my God.
And Brooks, the boys were naked. Coral was also naked, and he was molesting them. Coral screamed at Brooks, "What are you doing here?" And Brooks just ran out of the apartment. He was 15 at the time.
Oh, my God.
So, just, like, totally shocking and definitely, like, super hard for him, you know?
Of course.
And after Brooks walked into this, so also, we don't know who these victims are. Mm-hmm. Like, there's mixed accounts that it might be these two boys that I'll talk about later, but mm-hmm. I don't think it's them, and we mm-hmm. don't know who they are. And
it wasn't anyone that Brooks knew.
No, because he only saw them quickly, too, so.
Right.
So after this happens, Dean told Brooks, like, I'm a part of this, like, child pornography ring that blah blah blah, like, I'll give you a new car if you keep quiet. So Coral,
was that the truth? Was he part of this ring?
Police now think that he might have actually
been okay, part of a ring. But we don't know for sure.
Yeah, we don't know for sure, so mm-hmm. I'll get into it later. But so Brooks got a brand new green Corvette and didn't say anything. He was 15.
But his parents didn't notice and ask, where did you get this car?
Well, his mom lived in Beaumont, and I guess it might not have even been weird because, like, Dean had so taken him under his wing, you know, and his parents didn't really care about him. Like, he was a latchkey kid.
Right.
I bet they didn't even notice, you know, so. A few weeks later, Coral admitted to Brooks that he killed the two boys. And he offered Brooks $200 for each boy he brought to Coral. That night, in that 1970 money, that is
a lot.
$1,400
now. Oh my God.
So this is when Brooks becomes his accomplice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go back a little bit into the first person we think that officially is known as Dean Coral's first victim. There's a lot of speculation that maybe he was doing this by himself for a long time before he brought Brooks in, but this is right. the only one that Brooks knows about from before he started with him. So
okay.
His name is Jeffrey Conan, and he disappeared on September 25th, 1970. And remember, Brooks walked in on Coral mm-hmm. in December 1970, so this is just 2 months before.
Mm-hmm.
Jeffrey Conan was 18 years old, and he was a college freshman at the University of Texas in Austin. He was hitchhiking home to see his parents in Houston, and he was hitchhiking with a friend. And when they got to Houston, Jeffrey Conan was dropped off alone on Westheimer Road. Coral lived on a cross street to Westheimer called York Street. So what we believe happened is that Coral picked him up and offered to give him a ride, like, that last leg, because he was super close to his house. When they found the body, the medical examiner concluded that Jeffrey Conan died of asphyxiation caused by manual strangulation, and a cloth gag had been placed in his mouth.
Oh my God.
He was found buried underneath a large boulder, wrapped in plastic, naked and bound. Investigators believe he was sexually assaulted, and he was found at High Island Beach in Texas. This was a very clean scene. Like, the body was never found until Brooks. So Coral, after Brooks found out about all of, like, that he was molesting these kids, Coral brought him Brooks to this body and was like, this is where this kid is buried. So that's how they found the body, because Brooks later mm-hmm. brought the police to the body. Like, it was super well hidden. The kill was, like, really clean, like, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. So police now really don't think this was Coral's first murder.
Right. How can it be so perfect, as you say, if it was the first one?
Exactly. And so then the next two that we know of are those two unnamed boys who Brooks walked in on Coral torturing. And then we get to the next
two. Did we ever find their bodies?
I'll get into it, but basically the second, so they found 27 bodies.
Okay.
And then a few years later, another body washed up on the shore that they think is another one of Dean Corll's victims on the beach that they just didn't find because the accomplices were kept saying there's more bodies, there are more bodies. But at the time when they were undigging all the bodies, the police, once they got to 27, they had beat the previous record in California for the serial killer, so they stopped looking for bodies.
You're joking.
No. And I actually wanted to do this case because Texas EquiSearch or something. EquiSearch. Still believe there's 20 missing bodies, and they're going to start searching again in the next few weeks.
That's great. At least they're doing something.
Yeah. So. I forgot where I was going with that, but that's what's going on. So then,
okay.
So remember Brooks walked into Corll torturing these boys in early December. Mm-hmm. And on December 13th, 1970, James Glass and Danny Yeats disappeared. They were both 14 years old and they were best friends who lived in the Houston Heights neighborhood. They were attending a youth church service with Jimmy's dad and older brother, Willie. Jimmy and Danny had gone to sit near the front, and during the middle of the service, they walked up the aisle to leave, and they were never seen again. They were labeled as runaways by the police, even though their families insisted that was not the case. Jimmy had apparently run away to a friend's house before when he had had arguments with his father, so that's why they labeled him a runaway. And then for Danny, the police said that there had been a sighting of him at a runaway house, like a common runaway house, so they labeled him a runaway.
But how can you just label the runaway? Like, do more work until you determine that's a runaway. You can't just go off like the rumor.
The police had 40 plus missing boys in the same neighborhood labeled them all as runaways.
Oh my god.
The police didn't catch these people.
Right.
Like, the police didn't catch Dean Corll.
Yeah.
Someone killed him.
Yeah.
Like, the police had no idea. This was not on their radar. They never found a body themselves. They didn't do any investigative work here.
They weren't even trying.
They weren't trying. Jimmy James Glass wore funky printed shirts. He loved, like, leather and beaded necklaces, and he always wore this leather fringe jacket. He was super cute. His hair was super parted to the side, and he was a little heartbreaker. Like, girls loved him. Mm-hmm. And then Danny Yates, he was also very handsome. He had curly brown hair, blue eyes, and he actually had a girlfriend named Betty at the time, and Betty still keeps his picture in her jewelry box. Isn't that sweet? She's like in her 50s now. She's remarried. She's married, but she's like, that was my first love. I'll never forget him. So their families did literally everything they could to find them. They posted flyers all over Houston. They put ads in the paper. Danny's family got a tip that someone saw him in Monterey. So his father drove to Monterey, Mexico. Like, this was so hard on their families. And apparently this, like, ruined Danny's father because he thought that maybe Danny ran away because he was so hard on him. But what actually happened is that Jimmy Glass was an acquaintance of Brooks, and he had actually been to Corll's apartment before. And Brooks
got them to go. Wait, these are the two best friends?
The two best friends. They knew Jimmy. Jimmy Glass knew Brooks.
Oh, wow.
From the neighborhood, and Brooks.
Yeah.
Got them to get in the car, and he took them to Dean Corll's. And this is the start of Brooks' involvement in the first boys he brings to Corll. The boys were strapped to a torture board, raped, strangled, and buried in a boat shed that Dean Corll had rented. There was an electrical cord with alligator clips buried with Danny Yates's body. So that he might have been getting tortured through, like, electrocution. And the police never investigated. They just told their parents they were runaways. I'm going to do two more people, and then I'm going to save the rest for the second half.
Okay.
So Donald and Jerry Waldrop, they went missing on January 30th, 1971. They were brothers. Donald was 15 and Jerry was just 13. This is one of the youngest victims of Coral.
13.
Their father had just dropped them off at a friend's house so they could start a bowling team and talk about their bowling league, but their friend wasn't home. So they started walking to the bowling alley. Brooks and Coral were driving down the street and they said, "Hey, you guys want to party? Jump in the van. We can all go party at Coral's house." So Coral would like have like drugs and alcohol and do these like paint and glue sniffing parties at his apartment. So everyone, all the teenage boys thought, "Oh, it's cool. We can party there. Like he's all cool. Right. He's cool." So it became like a party pad.
Sounds like Gacy in a way too. That was like Gacy's thing. "Oh, it's so fun. Come on, let's hang." It's so manipulative. Yeah. It's so sad.
Yeah. So, and like they like Brooks is young. Like Brooks is around their age, you know, like, right. So they just get in the car. Like they just think it's normal. So, they got in the van and this is the first time Brooks actually watched Coral rape, torture and strangle the boys to death. They were also buried in the boat shed. These boys only lived a half mile away from where Jimmy and Danny went missing, but the police labeled Donald and Jerry Waldrop as runaways as well.
You are joking.
They lived a half mile away, and it was a month later.
Oh, two my boys, God, the incompetence.
Same MO.
The incompetence.
Their father filled out missing person paperwork and told the Houston Chronicle that he camped out on that police department door for 8 months straight.
Oh my God.
I was there about as much as the chief was, but all they said was, "Why are you here? You know your boys are runaways."
Why would they be runaways? Like, give me a reason why they would be runaways.
They were going to plan their bowling league. Why did they run away?
They obviously have plans.
And they just blamed it. This is the 70s. This is the hippie movement. Like, everyone's going to be in cults. Like, all your kids are runaways. There's no one. They did this constantly, though. They did this to all the victims, a ton of victims of Ted Bundy. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, exactly. But once it becomes such a coincidence, like, you don't have an excuse. I'm sorry. If you want to make that excuse for the first victim, whatever. I mean, I don't want to say whatever, but you know what I'm saying. But when it becomes that there's four boys within a half mile, like, are you serious?
And there's the fifth boy that went missing that was a little bit older in college that went missing in the same like area 3 months too, before, no? too, in the same area. And, I mean, it gets to there's 47-plus missing boys in this area in, it's like, 5 years. And
they, it's purposefully the police never looking away. It. It's on purpose.
Purposefully. And I think another thing is that it's because they were boys, too.
Sure,
and they were from a lower class neighborhood, and their parents didn't have money. Their parents didn't have a say in what was going on. Mm-hmm. And the cops didn't care about them.
Right.
So that's part one.
Okay.
Of Dean Coral.
Wow.
It's
a lot worse. Already, but I mean,
there was definitely retribution in his death in a way.
Okay. Well, I'm excited to listen. I hope there's like a resolution. And I'm happy to hear a little bit about if they're going to continue searching.
I know. I am really excited. I haven't actually gotten to that research yet. I just know they're doing it. But I think that's also like another reason I wanted to do this case, just to like bring it back into the light. Basically, like the rumor is that they were having prisoners like do a lot of the like searching for the bodies. And then everyone got tired. It smelled really bad. They had beat the record in California and they just stopped.
Oh my God.
And they misidentified multiple boys.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of hard before DNA, but now hopefully
they fixed a lot of it with DNA.
Okay. Okay. Good.
Like a lot of families have come forward and said, like, "I don't think I buried my son. Like, I think you gave us the wrong person."
Okay. Wow. So the families are very cooperative and that's because to a that's point, hard.
But I mean, so there's 27 known victims.
Right.
In 3 years.
Oh my God.
All from the same neighborhood. If the police did any investigation, they all knew Coral and Brooks.
Right. Like, come on, it's not that hard.
No, and we've gotten through five of them. There's 22 yeah. more that I'm going to talk about.
Yeah, good. We should all hear their names.
Yeah, for sure. And we'll post their pictures too. They're so sweet and little. Like, I actually was freaking out last night looking at all their photos. It was making me so sad. Hopefully you have a better rest of your day than having to worry about this.
That was really heavy. But I mean, it's always important to be conscious of these stories, I think.
Yeah, and to tell their story, because a lot of times the Dean Quarles stuff doesn't get as much press because he died. He was never interviewed. Right. Like, it wasn't as sensationalized
either. Yeah.
Yeah. And so his victims don't get a lot. And they're so young. Like, their names need to be heard. People need to know who they were. And like,
absolutely.
They need to be remembered for like who they were, not just that they were victims of Dean Quarles.
So. Absolutely. Thank you for telling the story.
Thank you guys for listening. And thank you for listening, Carmen. I love you.
I love you more.
Okay. So right. That was Murder Show.
Thanks for listening. Woo. If you like us and you want to hear the end of the story and then want to hear what other stories we tell in the future, please make sure to subscribe to us on whatever podcast listening streaming service that you prefer. And also follow us on Instagram at Murder Show Pod, I believe it is. I'm always messing it up.
Yes.
Murder Show Pod. You can email us at murdershowpod@gmail.com for any case suggestions or corrections, or just to say hi as well. And what else, Lil?
And our Patreon is patreon.com/murdershow. And we're going to start doing like extra episodes there and just giving some like fun stuff there if you want to support us. It's also the best way to like help us get the podcast more professional, get better microphones, all that stuff. So we really appreciate your help. Thank you so much. I'm excited to hear your story next week.
Yes, it's going to be a long one as well, so I'm sorry. But it's...
Yeah, well, we're going to try to get these other parts out like faster than slower, just because we know it sucks to wait. But thank you guys for listening.
Thank you. Bye.